This is something we're extremely excited about, and this is something that fans both of Xavier and everybody across the college basketball world can be looking forward to.
We wanted this to be different. We wanted to highlight Sean Miller. We wanted to highlight your stories. You spent a lifetime in this game of basketball, and I feel like there's a market there. People are eager to hear what you have to say. And from our perspective, you know, I think people might wonder, why did you want to do this with these two guys over here?
I think this gives me the opportunity to talk about a game that I love, a city in particular, Cincinnati, and a place, Xavier, both as a university and a basketball program. That means a lot to me, and we could do it in more of a fun, lighthearted way. I'm Sean Miller, head basketball coach at Xavier University. Basketball has always been a part of my life. It's a game that means a lot to me. It's given me friendships and relationships that I'll carry with me forever. But basketball's also given me many stories, and those stories are something I'm excited to explore. Welcome to the Sean Miller Podcast.
You went on a recruiting visit to Providence when Rick Pitino was the head coach. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I started playing a game when I was really young. You know, a lot of people remember I would do halftime shows and different things as far back as when I was 9 years old, 10 years old. How that happened was simply back then there were no baskets lower than 10 feet. So if you were in the gym constantly, what did you do with the basketball? You learned how to dribble. You know, back to my dad being a great teacher. But I didn't want to be known as a showman, and, you know, I didn't really grow until about my 11th grade year. And in some ways, I became a late bloomer as a player. But when I hit the 11th grade summer before my senior year, I started to be recruited at a pretty high level. Pitt at that time was in the Big East Conference. They were a rising power. Providence was coached by Rick Pitino. Virginia, Terry Holland. And then there was just other schools that, you know, you always wanted to go to when you were a young kid. For me, it was Carolina, Dean Smith. But anyway, it came down to my final three schools were Virginia, Pitt, and Providence. And I made three official visits. I really, in some ways, maybe it's because I'm a coach, Adam, but I could probably tell you about all three visits. You know, that's how memorable they are in my mind, going back to 1987. But when I visited Providence, it was new because Coach Pitino, and ironically, he's the coach at St. John's today, you know, he was one of the game's best, an amazing teacher, a lot like my dad, was revolutionizing the three-point shot and introducing it in a different way to college basketball. And he had a guard on his team who really I admired, Billy Donovan. I looked at myself as a version of Billy, and if I was going to be successful in college, I had to follow a path like Billy Donovan blazed. So when I visited Providence, Billy Donovan was my host, and we went up there, and I visited with a number of other good high school players at different positions. But Coach Pitino back then, and maybe he does it the same today, I don't know, he had a different philosophy than the other two visits, and that is he truly wanted to show you how much you were going to practice, how hard you were going to work, and how much they loved the game at Providence. And sure enough, like, that resonated with me to the point where, you know, it really almost scared me to death. We watched the practice maybe at 9 in the morning, maybe a player development practice. We came back in the afternoon, and I watched them press for about 2 hours. That was the second practice. And then we got to the third practice, and they went harder in the third practice than they did in the first and the second one. And I remember being on the visit with a couple of the guys and them looking at me saying, like, man, I don't know if I could come here and practice this much. And here I was, Mr., you know, have a ball in his hands, son of a high school coach. You know, this is what you're going to sign up for. You got to be super excited. It actually frightened me. I didn't know if I could run that much, you know, as I watched these guys. But Billy was my host. At the end of the day, I ended up choosing Pitt, and I'm glad I did. And it just goes to show that, you know, on a visit, a lot of different emotions could happen. When I visited Virginia, I really loved Virginia. They were in the ACC, and I loved the coaching staff. They recruited me very hard. I wasn't that far from Pittsburgh, where I grew up. And I went to a football game, and the student body would wear a tie to the game. I think they still do it. So even if you had a T-shirt on, you wore an orange or a blue tie. Me being from Pittsburgh, you know, Steelers fan and watching football, like, that scared me. You know, more than anything I remember on the visit, I remember thinking, like, I don't know if that fits me. At Providence, I loved Coach Pitino. I loved Billy Donovan. But I was like, man, I honestly don't know if I could. I think my body will break down. Pitt was the sweet spot. Home, John Calipari was the assistant recruiting. I loved him. Big East Conference. And I went with my gut there. Glad I did.
What are some of the things that you tell your staff like that when you talk about a story like that and you want maybe a new staff, if you're building a new staff, you come to Xavier and you're getting your guys that you want to go out there and recruit and find your next round of talent. You tell that story, what's their reaction and what do you hope they get from that?
So when I was at Arizona, we had a football coach, Rich Rodriguez. You guys would have remembered him as much coaching West Virginia and Michigan, and he became a friend of mine. And I loved the way that he coached because, you know, Rich's philosophy recruiting, especially at West Virginia and Arizona, was he wasn't going to be able to get the high school All-American. And what he tried to get is what he called OKGs. And it the abbreviation is our kind of guys. And what it meant is, you know, in his offensive system, if you follow him, he loves the small, quick guys that if you get them the ball in space, they can run for an 80-yard touchdown. Defensive lineman, he wasn't trying to get the biggest, strongest, but he wanted quick defensive linemen. And he really had it wired so that everybody on his staff would identify, these are the types of players that fit us and the characteristics that allow them to be successful. You know, if you put that spin to basketball, you know, I think especially here at Xavier, we want people and players that love the game. I've never seen a player improve, back to Coach Pitino's story. It's hard to go to Providence unless you just really loved it. And if you didn't love it, it would be hard to survive that environment where basketball was so important. And I think when you look at us here at Xavier, those that continue to develop, that can fight through the adversity and obstacles, usually have a passion and love of the game that's deep. And they're willing to go the extra mile. They're willing to put that extra hard work in. You know, back to my story about Providence, it wasn't that I didn't love the game or that scared me. I just could not believe the workload is put in one day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're 18 years old, it was an impression that was more like, wow, I've never seen guys work like this before. And I've carried that with me until today as a coach. But so the OKG is something that I think every staff that I've been a part of, I try to keep in mind. You know, great example of if you really are trying to get somebody to come to our program who rebounds the ball, why would you ever ignore how many rebounds he gets in high school? If a guy is getting 5 rebounds a game in high school and he's 6'9 and he jumps to the gym, what makes you think that you can make him rebound better than the 5 that he got in high school? Like, that's something that really translates. So another characteristic of our kind of guy is he produces where he's at. Not that he can't go from 12 points a game to 16 or incrementally get better at what he does, but if you're bringing him in here to be a rebounder, you want him to rebound at the place he's already at, and then make him better. Great example is David West. Another great example is Tyrone Hill. If you track those two guys, I don't care what game they played at before they came to Xavier, I guarantee you they are one of the best rebounders in the game. And then here, what did they do? They became one of the nation's best. So, Des, a year ago, we all came together. First time you played for me as a head coach, our mm-hmm. staff, you're a freshman, mm-hmm. In the Big East Conference, away from home. Not for the first time, because mm-hmm. you had that experience with the schools that you attended, mm-hmm. right? We've talked about that as well. But really in college, it's a new chapter. And I think the most difficult year for anybody that's in college is that first year, in particular, even that first semester.
Right.
When you think back to your freshman year mm-hmm. in the classroom, in practice, weight room, mm-hmm. what it felt like to play in real games, home and away, crowds, what's the first couple of things that jump into the front of your mind when you think back to your freshman year here at Xavier?
You know, what I first thought, it was just like I was grateful to be here, you know, and get the opportunity. But I was like, man, it's tough. It's a big adjustment, you know, from, you know, starting with basketball first, like playing a lot with older guys, which I think helped me, obviously in the long run. But the pace of playing faster, everybody being quicker, faster, stronger, it's like I started from the bottom and had to catch up with everybody else. But, you know, you, including the staff, you know, they helped me and developed me a lot and to get where I'm at today. And then, you know, off the court, just moving around with academics, you know, I'm pretty much, you know, by myself now. You know, I'm not living under my parents' roof. So I would have to, it was an adjustment to hold myself accountable and, you know, and not be, you know, lazy in a way, but to grow up, basically.
What's the thing that caught you off guard the most? Like, if you're talking to somebody who's a high school senior, mm-hmm. and they're following your path, they're going to choose a college, play at the highest level in mm-hmm. college, right? Basketball, even football, other sports.
Yeah.
And it's like everybody told you what was coming, but until mm-hmm. you went through it, you didn't know. What is it that caught you off guard the most?
I would just say practicing and going 110% every rep, you know, every time, pushing yourself past the limit that you never thought you really had. I would say that would be like the only thing that caught me, you know, off guard. And to get, you know, past that, you know, it takes a lot of work and, you know, a lot of effort. And if you could get through it, it'll really benefit.
That in the last year that you've been back when I covered the team, I've heard you say more times than I can remember, and that's do what we do. And I'm curious, as a young coach who's trying to figure out what your style is, what defense you want to play, the types of players that you want to recruit, how do you figure out what it is exactly that you want to do, that you are?
So back then, Tony Dungy was the coach of the Indianapolis Colts. I'm a big NFL fan. I think the NFL coaches have more pressure on them than any of us. And it's just amazing the parity in that league. What separates a Super Bowl champion from somebody who doesn't make the playoffs is about five plays sometimes. You know, it's crazy to think about. But I read Tony Dungy's book. If you named the book, I would say that's it. But it's really, I think he at this point has wrote more than one. But it was the book that really talked about him becoming a Super Bowl champion with the Indianapolis Colts. And throughout the book, he talked a lot about do what we do. And in his context and way of saying it is, as an elite athlete, elite team, an NFL player and coach, you're only in control of so many things. If an injury happens, there's nothing you can do about it. But what in fact you are in control of is your everyday process. You know, the implementation of your system, holding people accountable, being positive versus negative, all the different things that entail a season, a coach, building a program. And he would say it all the time, do what we do. The other part of it that he talked about is you can only be good at so many things in sports. You know, if you think about Syracuse and Jim Boeheim and being the great Hall of Fame coach that he is, he never apologized for playing a 2-3 zone. It's what he did. People would say to him all the time, hey, it doesn't seem like it's working. Why don't you switch to man-to-man? And he would almost be offended by that. And that's because he believes so strongly in his rationale and reasoning behind why he plays a 2-3 zone. He recruited to the 2-3 zone. He knew how to build it. He knew what it meant in March Madness. So he may not be a good man-to-man coach, but he was a great zone coach. Like, he knew exactly what he did. You know, Bob Knight, who recently passed away, you know, if you think about his set plays, he would draw actions up in a timeout that were amazing actions, but he was a motion coach. Like, he redefined how offenses thought about the game, and he believed in screening and cutting and movement. But if you'd ask him to play a 2-3 zone, he'd probably laugh at you, right? I think the greatest coaches that you study and learn, they knew who they are. And they're about, this is who we are. This is why we do it. We do what we do. And we're going to be great at it. So instead of looking for the next thing or the trick play or deviating from what you do, why don't you do what you do better? And what is it that I can do to teach better, to practice better, to get that player to do that one thing that's going to help our offense better? So I'm not going to get spread out and diverted. I'm going to be good at a few things, and these are my core principles. So for me at Xavier, especially the first time, I went, burned all the boats and said, we're going to be the best man-to-man defensive team that I could possibly create. We're going to recruit to it. We're going to teach it. I'm going to study it. My staff's going to know it. We're going to believe in it, and we're never going to deviate. You're not going to ever see us play a possession in zone. That was a big change from who I was in my first year as a coach, and that led me to being, you know, a coach for a long time like that.
I think, you know, we've talked a lot on this show about you've done this for a really long time, and I think the expectation going into every season is that there will be hardships. You're going to run into some roadblocks. Things are not always going to go according to plan. What's that like when they arrive? Like, it's probably something that even 19 years in, you're not used to.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things that I have learned, and I've learned from older coaches, those that are even older than me. Number one, I think as a coach in any sport, you have to be true to yourself. You have to be your authentic self. That doesn't mean you try to you don't try to improve who you are and what you've done in the past. But for the most part, you have to be true to how you're wired. Like I'm a one-dimensional basketball-only person, right? I love my family, but when you talk about what are your other interests, coach, you have to have other sports. You have to do other things. You know, I can try them, but I've just been wired a certain way since I've been about 7 years old. So, you know, the win and the loss in the past for me is when you win, you live to coach another day. And when you lose, you die for a period of time until you revive yourself. I'm not that way at the moment. It may not feel that way to everybody. But look, one thing about college sports, and I take the mantle of being the head coach at Xavier very seriously. We're supposed to win, and we're supposed to be in the tournament. And our biggest games on our schedule should bring out the best in our group. And when that doesn't happen, we have to fix that. That's not okay. And I think anybody that tries to put a silver lining on that is either lying or they're not going to be around to see the next day very often. College sports is about being successful. And while we go through the process, what you learn as a coach is there's no better lesson for our players than going through these tough times. It allows them to deal with adversity off the court and in their own future more. They learn the power of camaraderie, of togetherness. They get the sense that if they're not together or they don't have that great camaraderie, you can only go so far in life. That's going to be in the job that they have one day, in the family that they raise, in life outside of sports when these hurdles and trial and tribulations come their way. There's no better classroom than going through these hardships as a college basketball team and program. So I think as the coach, going through it with them, holding them accountable is part of our responsibility, you know? So that's how we try to look at it. And I also think that will spur on growth and development in both our team and also especially in our freshmen.
The Sean Miller Podcast is proud to partner with Deer Park Roofing, a company that's provided elite service for homes and businesses since 1996 and leads the industry in professionalism, quality, and responsiveness. Whether your needs are residential or commercial, like the outstanding work on the Cintas Center, the home of Xavier basketball, Deer Park can handle any job and ensure it's done right. Deer Park's motto is protect what's important, and what's important to you is important to Deer Park Roofing. Visit DeerParkRoofing.com.
I'm from Boston, Massachusetts.
Milano, Italy.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
St. Louis, Missouri.
Abuja, Nigeria.
And
I chose Xavier University.
For its education,
more opportunities.
For passion.
Because it felt like home.
The community.
Campus life.
D1 basketball.
Because I love Cincinnati.
I came here
to be a Musketeer.
I am.
I am.
I am.
And we are the faces of Xavier.
So my wife still talks about this, BJ. I wouldn't say it was my finest moment, but it was a moment. Mm-hmm. So It would have been BJ's senior year, and he had talked about it. We were coming off of an Elite Eight. We were highly ranked. He was one of, I would say, two or three leaders on our team. And we had obviously a really good team as well. We got off to a great start in your senior year. We went to the San Juan Shootout in Puerto Rico.
Yep.
And we played three teams. Virginia Tech. Dante Jackson hit an 80-foot shot at the buzzer to win.
Mante Rampage. Shout out, baby.
We played Missouri. And Missouri was a 3 seed, I think, that year at the time. They were really, really good. A couple players that were on their team are playing in the NBA. And we played Memphis. And Memphis was a 1 or 2 seed. We won all three games. I mean, I remember a friend of mine called after the tournament and said, how does it feel to be on Thanksgiving Day and know you're already in the NCAA tournament? But we got off to a great start, and BJ was the leader. So we had this game scheduled in early December, and it was in New Jersey, and we played Duke. Now, what I didn't realize as the young coach is Duke, for Coach K, he always really targeted that game as almost their final tune-up before ACC began. And he would pick a team that he thought would be good, and they were going to put all efforts in for that week and go there. If you know anything about Duke, New Jersey and New York, they have a ton of fans. What I didn't know is I think at that point he would have been like 21-0 in that game. Like he had played a version of that game for 20 years and had never lost. So we would have been game 22. They had an excellent team. Matter of fact, John Shire was playing. He was great on that day. Anyway, I'm going to shorten the story. We're on CBS. We were ranked. And I remember giving these guys a pep talk. We're going to go to Duke. We're going to compete against Duke. We got no fear. We're not flinching. We're going to show everybody how tough we are. We're undefeated. We play the best of the best. Everything you could say to a group of guys, that's what I would have said. And I really think we probably all believed it. We were down, I think, 23-0.
That thing was over so quick.
They actually, after the end of the game, people would say, you know, we really weren't able to watch it. That's the good news, because they turned your game off 8 minutes in. I mean, they beat us. They beat us so bad. I mean, you could still feel it today. Yeah. So during the game, young coach just trying to get the most out of my team. You know, I was looking around. BJ may have screwed something up or missed a couple of shots. Man, I really went at him in the huddle. And I have a habit, and I realize this, I'm trying to get away from it. Back then it was way worse. When I really get upset in the huddle, I spit. I'm not trying to spit on anyone, but it just...
All over your face.
Yeah.
It's bad. But, you know, where he's
coming
from.
I've got a lot better at that.
And I think I remember, because at that point in time, I think I was a little nervous, or, you know, I don't know the situations, but I want to stretch. It's out there on tape somewhere. My first shot of those particular games were air balls. I still remember to this day. Every first shot that I shot for the prior 2 or 3 games were air balls. And I airballed the first shot in that game. And, I mean, he ripped into me. I'm tired of seeing it. Scared.
Pretty good impression.
So here's where I'm going on this story. Keep in mind now that's 15 years ago, 16 years ago at this point. So in fact, I remember this must have been something, right? Yeah. So what I didn't realize is back to BJ's dad, and BJ's dad is a big man. I mean, how tall?
He's a little taller than me. He's about 6'7", 6'8", something
6'8".
Like that. 6'8". Yeah, 6'8".
And he takes up the room. I mean, he looks the part, and he's right behind the bench because that's where our parents' seats were. Well, I had no idea he was right behind the bench. My wife, who was at the game, she was in that area as well. So because she was that close, she heard everything that I said as well. And she has to sit about 2 seats over from BJ's dad. Well, there's two parts to this. First, after the game, you know, I'm like, I can't believe we lost this bad. My wife looked at me and said, I cannot believe you yelled at BJ Raymond like that. Do you know his dad was one row behind the bench? You're lucky he didn't get up and just knock you out. And I'm like, I didn't say anything wrong to BJ. You didn't say anything wrong to BJ. You were spitting and blah, blah, poor kid just sat there and listened. And, I mean, it's Duke. What do you expect? I mean, blah, blah, blah. Okay, I get it. I remember thinking like, God, she's right. BJ's dad. So I saw him probably about 2 or 3 weeks later. I said, Ben, first of all, I want to apologize. I probably, not intentionally, went at BJ too much. He's our leader. I love him. And we needed him to be more of a leader in that moment. And I went, and you probably heard every word. And he said, Coach, you never, ever have to worry about getting on my son. That's why he's at Xavier. And that's why he's going to be good. And he knows you care about him. And don't even waste 5 seconds telling me or apologizing. I did hear it. He goes, now, I will tell you, when the spit started coming and hitting me, I knew you were mad. But there'll be a long line of guys that would say, oh, when he gets mad, spit. I really try my very best to be in control of it today. I'd say, look, I'm 50% better at least, aren't I, DJ?
I don't know about that. But yeah, no, well,
I was reading the box score of that game last night getting ready for this and thinking back to that, and that Duke game. What stands out to you from that game? I mean, you said how quickly you felt like it was over, but I feel like that game in some ways, when you think back to that team and the experience that you guys had on that team, I mean, is that a game that stands out to you, or is that one you just kind of wipe away?
Oh, I wipe it away. I can remember the funny points, like my coach getting on me airballing the shot. I came out of halftime, I made a shot and growled at the bench, the Duke bench, and he said, go, running down the court, coach, shut up, the game's already over.
And I was right.
You're too late.
It's a popular topic. I've asked you about it a lot. Everyone seems to ask you about it a lot, and it's this word, toughness. And in my mind, I think growing up and playing sports, like, I always equated toughness with like an unwillingness to back down, like a physical connotation with that word. But I think like the more I've been around basketball and the more I've been around you, to me, toughness is making the right decisions with the basketball. It's going to the line when the game is on the line and making free throws. It's being responsible for blocking out your man. And I thought like tonight was a tough performance from your team. I mean,
for sure. Davion
didn't miss at the line. Quincy didn't miss at the line.
Yeah.
Like, is that how you evaluate a game like this?
For sure. You know, one thing about basketball that's unique, and it's obviously the sport that I love. You think about it. I mean, there's a lot of sports that are amazing, but they're not two-way players, right? Football, play offense or defense. And, you know, you think about like the roles in different sports. Basketball with five players, all five are equally responsible for both sides of the ball. So cultivating two-way players, allowing a player to go from a made three to playing good defense, a turnover to not worrying or letting that linger and move on to the next play. You know, it's like next play. I think it's so important. You define toughness during a game a lot of times by how well does your group, your team, go from one thing to the next, because basketball is such a quick change game. It can go from 70 to 64 winning to 70 to 70 in what feels like 30 seconds. And most of the time when a quick change like that happens, you have a player or a team or a group that's still caught up in what just happened and hasn't moved on to getting back in transition or not fouling, or the shot went up and instead of watching it, you didn't block out, right? So, and you see, even at the end, we have to get better at communicating. At the end, I'm reaching out, I'm yelling out. It looks like I'm yelling at them. I'm really not yelling at them as much as trying to get their attention. But tonight was one of the first times all year with this team that we were in a really close game and had a lead, and we had to hold on to the lead to win it.
Yep.
I don't know if we've been in a game like that. Like when we beat St. Mary's, we had a large lead, so some of these things didn't come into play. How many timeouts do you have? Does a player know that if he doesn't have the ball, he can call a timeout? Can you run the baseline, yes or no? That's a big deal. So, you know, going through this for the first time tonight, it can be maddening as a coach, right? Because we have a group of guys that have never, ever gone through that particular situation before. And that's why experience is so important. And that's one of the things that's challenging for our group right now. Every time we play a game, we get more experienced And tonight we really got more experienced together and we had success, which gives you confidence. You know, leading into the Delaware game, we were gaining experience. You could make the case that we played as hard and maybe as well for a lot of the Houston game as we did tonight, but we didn't win. You start to lose that next game, you can feel the lack of confidence. And I thought more than any game we've played this year, the second half against Delaware, it wasn't our guys giving in as much as they lost their confidence. They did. They lost their belief. We got it back, and I thought tonight, especially how we finished the game, and look, we were a disaster in the first 4 minutes of the second half, but to see that same group repair it, Quincy do what he did to help us repair it, and us finish the second half, I think it's rewarding, and I believe that maybe that leads us into the next game in a positive way.
To your point, before you ask your question, to your point about closing out a close game, you know, Xavier and Cincinnati played a lot of close games over the years, but when it's been close, it's always been Xavier. In the last 28 shootouts, Xavier's now 12-0 in games decided by 7 points or fewer, and in the other 16, they're 8-8. Series is even. So yeah. When it comes down to it, it's always been Xavier that's found a way to close things out. You guys have done so many iconic moments, whether it's the Elite Eights, whether it's, you know, all the NCAA tournaments, whatever it might be. Is there one game that sticks out? Maybe it's not your favorite, but when you think of a broadcasting moment, you get asked this question. What's the first moment that comes to mind? I mean, most recently, an NIT championship. I mean, there have been a lot of moments. But what, Joe, you got a look on your face.
West Virginia. B.J. Raymond made two shots, a three-pointer on the right wing on a pass that came from the other side of the court on an inbounds play. Then he had a shot, which Byron did a wonderful job on the broadcast. I think you can see it out in the halls out here. There's a big photograph of it where B.J. Raymond was open at the top of the key. And it was one of those plays, and Paul, you know you've done a lot of play-by-play, where you can kind of see what's going to happen. You see it developing. You kind of got a little sight into the future. Well, B.J. gets open, and you can see him start to coil for the shot. And Byron's going to have to help me here, but you said, what did you say at the time?
I said, do it, B.J., do it.
And he kind of shouted it with emphasis. The next thing, B.J. lost that three-point shot, and it spins to the bucket, going through the string. Xavier beats West Virginia, yep. And they advance to the Elite Eight. That's I actually have a photograph in my office at home of Byron and myself in the background with B.J. taking one of those two shots.
It's a great picture. We showed that during the episode. Yeah, your reaction right behind is just iconic. Yeah, it's great.
And I'm thrilled that B.J. Raymond's an assistant coach here. And every once in a while, I'll remind him of the thrill he gave me when he made those two shots.
Yep.
So. Byron?
I guess my favorite moment was, this was a game that Xavier did not win. This was, I think, we're on the West Coast. Xavier was playing against Kansas State. Oh, yeah. And I think we went to overtime. Kenny Freeze was on that team. But to Holloway, it was a back and forth game.
Great game.
I think Crawford was playing for Xavier at the time. I'm not sure. But I know to Holloway was on the team. And it was a close game, back and forth. So close. I think it was maybe the last game in that region for the day. And, you know, this was on the West Coast, and not a lot of Xavier fans, not a lot of Kansas State fans, but the fans that were there just were so into it because it was back and forth. And to Holloway gets fouled with 0.1 seconds on the clock. And the entire arena was standing up because they were so on the edge of their seats to see what was going to happen. And at the end of the year, I get really nervous on games a little bit more because I don't want this to end.
Yeah.
You know, it's the NCAA tournament. You lose, you go home. So I was a little bit more on edge than normal. So I remember him going to the free throw line, and there was so much pressure. And that was such a pressure spot. And to Holloway went to the free throw line. They were down three with less than a second to go. Everyone's on their feet, and he steps to the free throw line, just cold as the other side of the pillow, man. One, two, three. He made three free throws in the row. the entire like season was on the line at that point.
Yeah.
And the ice in his veins, I was so nervous, I couldn't even speak. You know, I was just sitting there with my mouth open, like half praying. And Joe was just continues to go on. I mean, the thing I love about him, he never gets nervous. You know, if I get tongue-tied for a second, I know Joe will just pick it up and just keep on going, you know? So I hope I don't do that as much as I used to. But
no, you do a great
job. I'm still
a
work in progress. But anyway, but yeah, Joe just kind of kept talking us through that. And I just remember being so impressed with the grit of Tu Holloway in that moment. The gravity of that moment was just iconic and awesome to be a part of. And Xavier ended up losing in overtime. But it to me, that was the biggest moment as a broadcaster that I had ever experienced.
I think that game eats me alive more than maybe any other, because what people forget about that game is that if Xavier had won that game, they would have played Butler in the next round to go to the Final Four. And Xavier had already played Butler that season and just narrowly, it might have been by 1 point, 2 points, had just barely lost to Butler earlier in that season. And I don't remember who on that team, but I remember talking to somebody on that team a couple of years ago and just thinking about the opportunity that you had to play Butler to then go to the Final Four that you didn't get because you lost to Kansas State in double overtime. But
Paul, how old were you when that time happened? So were you in diapers or what?
Ready for this? Ready for this one. So I'm from Northern Virginia. I mentioned that before here on the show. I'm from Northern Virginia. I was in bed. I think I was, I'd have been like 10 or 11 years old, maybe 12. I don't know, somewhere in there. 10, 11, 12, some 13. I don't know. Somewhere
You're
in there.
Terrible.
But it was before every NCAA tournament game was broadcasted everywhere. So I remember my mom was still awake downstairs and I could hear her screaming because she was watching the little animated guys on like the sports tracker, the game tracker online. Yeah. And you just had to watch the little animated balls shoot into the basket.
Yes.
And she's screaming when the little guy's, you know, making the shot, missing the shot. I'm waking, I'm going, it's 1-8, because that game was in Salt Lake City.
Yes.
So it's a time change. Yep. Oh man, that was great. Brutal on young Paul, but here we are.
Here we are.
Sean, Chris, both of you began your head coaching careers here at Xavier, but you both left for other opportunities. And Sean, I'll start with you. You left to become the head coach at Arizona. Chris, you left to become the head coach at Louisville. But Sean, going back to that decision to start here, but to then leave for something else, what do you remember about that decision-making process? Maybe what you talked to Chris about when he was going through that process himself, and now where you are being back here at Xavier?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to go back in time. Certainly, I was really torn, and it had nothing to do with the place that I was going, Arizona. It had everything to do with, I was here for 8 years. You know, 5 as the head coach, but 3 previous to those 5, people here treated me great. Like Chris said, first year, you know, you take over as a young coach, your record is 0-0, and look, not everybody was saying, hey, we got our guy, or this is going to work out great, but what we developed into was something that we all had a lot of pride in. I mean, we were a tough-minded team. We were a good program. And I think like all of us that became the head coach at Xavier, you always tried to take it for where you got it and say, what is it that I can do to move this thing forward? That's become increasingly more difficult as now we're in the Big East and the success of the past has been attained at so many different levels. I mean, Chris did arguably what I think is the hardest thing to do in college basketball, and that is be a 1 seed. You're a 1 seed in the NCAA tournament. That's reflective of a 32-game, 6-7-month years of recruiting to be one of the top 4 seeds of 370 teams.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so difficult. And everyone's going to remember, well, what did you do once the tournament began? And that works both ways for coaches, right? Sometimes you could be the 12 seed and get to the Elite Eight or Sweet 16. Sometimes you're the 1 seed and it doesn't work out. But to be a 1 seed, so the point of the very long-winded answer here is you have so much pride in being able to inherit the program, be responsible for moving it forward. And if, in fact, you accomplish that, it's not easy to say, I'm out. You know, let's move on. Like, you become attached to Cincinnati, to Xavier's University, to the great people that work here. And you know what else? To your players that you convinced to bring here, that you coached, that have worked really hard. When it's time to leave, it's not all what perception is. Oh, he's leaving. It must be easy for him. Man, it's not. So it was very, very difficult. The fact that I did it back then, I tried to do it for all the right reasons, and there's always, you know, the pluses and minuses of doing it. But one thing that I will say, in the 13 years that I was gone at Arizona, I never lost respect or appreciation for Xavier. And some of it was easy because, you know, Chris was here and people that I really care about were here, but I never lost that. Like, I always inherently followed Xavier really closely, respected Xavier, and we're talking about the two times that we matched up, right? So that always remained inside of me. But to leave here was very difficult, not because of the place that I went to, but because of how strongly I felt about this place and the city.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I was in a place that I was devastated that we lost to Florida State. I mean, I just, you know, we had Trayvon and JP and Sean, you know, for 4 years. And, you know, I had opportunities before that, but it just felt like with those guys, one seed, felt like everything was rolling. The game was in, I don't want to say in hand. That's wrong, because obviously it wasn't. But just thought that it, you know, the year before we were in the Elite Eight, this is sort of our destiny. And the next thing you know, it's just, you're looking at Karim Cantor and Sean, those guys with tears in their eyes in the locker room, and it was the hardest time I think that I'd been through as a head coach. And then you're faced with that decision like within 48, 72 hours. Like, and you know, I think a lot of things were misinformation out there that, you know, I had had something going on for so long with Louisville, and it's so far from the truth. And you know, for me, Sean had said he was here for 8 years. I was here for 14 straight.
Right.
14 straight. And, you know, felt like at the time I wanted to take on that challenge. You know, I think retrospectively you could say, hey, it was the wrong decision. But I don't ever look at it like that. I look at it like those things shape you. You know, just as I went through my knee injuries when I played here, I went through two ACLs and a third when I got done playing. That if those things hadn't happened to me, I wouldn't be the man or the person that I am. And so, you know, going to Louisville was a decision more about the next challenge. Had I known that the NCAA was never going to come out with a decision for 4 years while I was there, the decision probably would have looked differently. But I don't have regrets. I love everything about Xavier. I felt like we pushed ourselves to as far as we got, and it was just disappointing at the end. And I think that probably left a bitter taste in a lot of people's mouths. But, you know, for me, it was about the next challenge. And who knows what my next challenge is beyond that. But it was a hard decision. But at the time, I felt like it was the right one for me.
But if you look at how many years you spent in Xavier, as a player, two? Three?
Three. Three. I had to sit out a year.
Yeah, three. You were the director of ops with Skip for
two.
Two. So you're up to five. You're with me for five. Now we're at 10, and then you're the coach.
Nine.
I mean, when you're at a place.
And I think in that time, we went to like 17 NCAA tournaments in 19 years.
No doubt.
Years,
I was going to say that. You know, there's a stat that came out that since the creation of the NCAA tournament as a 64-team field, and then it became 68, which I believe is in the 1980s.
1985.
From 1985 until this moment, we're talking ranked the most total wins, not wins in the NCAA tournament, but, you know, from game one all the way to the end of the season. And I think our program is right at number 10.
11.
Number 11. Think about that.
That's incredible.
I think more than any stat, if you want to just talk about the true history of this place from a basketball perspective, to be able to say that since 1985 should make any player, any coach, anybody that's affiliated or a fan of Xavier basketball to be able to say that That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and the current head coach to have the weight of the world on his shoulders to keep that streak up.
It is what it is.
Well, I mean, you're at this point, you're the all-time winningest coach here, but you're right on the heels.
Yeah, I know.
Right on the heels.
He's going to pass me.
Yeah, well, we'll see. That's a tall order for sure. But no, Chris did, really did an incredible job here. I remember being at Arizona in my first year there, and we inherited a real change over from maybe the previous 3 or 4 years. And then I showed up as kind of like the fourth coach in 4 years. Almost doesn't sound right? The fourth coach in 4 years. But, you know, we were going to try to get one foot on the ground and see where it went as a new staff at Arizona. And I would watch the next year a lot of guys we were together with, and mm-hmm. we had a great group coming back. Jordan Crawford joined the team, and Mark Lyons joined the team. And watching them, I watched the game against Kansas State. Double overtime?
Yeah.
It seemed like quadruple overtime. It just went going on and on. But they were getting ready to play Brad Stevens and Butler in the Elite Eight to go to the Final Four. And I remember saying, like, man, I think Chris is going to go to the Final Four in his first year. You know, like, man. But that was a great team.
Oh, well, yeah. And I think, again, maybe I'm wrong, but I think if you would have been here, that might have kept Derek Brown one more year. Could be wrong.
Yeah.
But regardless, that team was
really good.
A talented team and a very focused team. And had we been fortunate enough to move past Kansas State, we would have played Butler, who we lost to with the whole clock episode. I think our guys would have been loaded for bear, and who knows. But.
One thing that I've learned over my time as a coach is the value of teaching everybody on your team the importance of jump stopping.
Right.
To play off 2 feet, to land on two, and how it protects you. At first, I think when you talk in those terms to a player, I think the initial reaction is, well, wait a second now. I'm not going to be able to play basketball, my game, right?
Right.
But I believe that it gives you new avenues. Right. It doesn't take away, I think, in terms of quality, efficiency. It allows you to be a much smarter, more efficient player.
I agree, for sure. You know it. Because in college basketball, you know, with the way they teach help defense and rotations and just matchups, playing off two gives you an extra second or two to make a decision that you might have thought was open. Somebody rotates, and then another avenue is opening. Playing off two gives you that grace period to let your mind slow down and make that decision.
And I believe that's a big quality for you. You know, you've done better, and I think there's even another level you can get at in the next 8-10 weeks here to be even more efficient than you already have become. And here's an example. We're playing early in the year against Washington. The game gets super fast. You catch it here on a closeout, and you jump stop. Like, instead of going off your left leg and maybe taking a tough two or potential turnover, just by jump stop, land on two, bounce pass to Sasha, 2 points. Great job. You know, our pace, we work on it every day. First 20 minutes of practice, I think you already know what's coming before you show up.
Yeah.
And it's, again, trying to develop an arsenal of different things you do, where you're a guard, you're a playmaker. You're not a shooting guard, a two guard, a point guard. You're a playmaking guard. Right. And here's an example of, again, your improvement, your steady improvement, where here you are, you really are point guard on this possession, and you make a great decision and score. Now, that's an example of you not playing off of 2 feet.
Right.
Because it presented itself as a layup.
Correct.
But what about the pace? What about playing in a style like we have? What is it that you jumps off the page for you?
I mean, the speed is crazy. But when you have someone like Davion as our point guard who pushes the ball at the speed he does, I mean, he makes it easier for me, you know, just to get a stop and then help crash the glass and then get out on the break. AC, Coach Cohen, pointed out to me earlier in the year, maybe like 3 weeks ago, that he pointed out how many points I've scored off transition. And I, when I think about it, it's really getting a stop. Davion pushing it, and I'm sprinting out in transition, and the defense still trying to match up who has who, where are they looking. But I'm already at the three-point line just because we play so fast. I'm automatically programmed to just sprint out to the wing. And when you look at it on film, it's not – is nowhere near as fast as it feels
when you're actually in the game. I agree with that. No question. Even you watch this right here, it looks actually kind of slow. But if you're sitting there and you're right at the court level, it's a lot faster than you think. And this is what you're talking about right here, where that looks super slow. But the reason they weren't matched up, right, is the pace. And these are all the ones where you have the ball. And back to Coach Cohen's point to you, it really is amazing. Against UC in particular, I thought the game broke open in a couple transition opportunities.
Correct.
And this is what you're talking about. Dez finding you with a great advance pass, but that right there is about as fast as you can play, and that was a huge shot in the middle of the second half. I tip my hat to you, Quincy, because just like a player doesn't truly know the program he's in until he gets there, you think you know, you've done your research, but until you live it and are with it every day, you don't really have that true understanding. It's the same coaching a player.
Right.
And I just watching how you've embraced leadership when we've talked about it, being more efficient on offense, which includes sacrifice, being a two-way player and holding yourself accountable to that side of the ball, no different than offense, and that routine and regimen we're talking about, you know, I feel like you're giving us your maximum in all those efforts. So I tip my hat to you. Happy New Year.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Happy New Year.
This has been the Sean Miller Podcast, presented by Deer Park Roofing, with your hosts, Paul Fritschner and Adam Baum. Join us again soon for another episode with the head coach of the Xavier Musketeers, Sean Miller.